All right, y'all, welcome to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. Let me start today with Dear Leader.
Good morning, everybody. Last night, on my orders, America's armed forces began strikes against ISIL targets in Syria. Today, the American people give thanks for the extraordinary service of our men and women in uniform, including the pilots who flew these missions with the courage and professionalism that we've come to expect from the finest military that the world's ever known. Earlier this month, I outlined for the American people our strategy to confront the threat posed by the terrorist group known as ISIL. I made clear that as part of this campaign, the United States would take action against targets in both Iraq and Syria, so that these terrorists can't find safe haven anywhere. I also made clear that America would act as part of a broad coalition, and that's exactly what we've done. We were joined in this action by our friends and partners, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Jordan, Bahrain, and Qatar. America's proud to stand shoulder to shoulder with these nations on behalf of our common security. The strength of this coalition makes it clear to the world that this is not America's fight alone. Above all, the people and governments of the Middle East are rejecting ISIL and standing up for the peace and security that the people of the region and the world deserve. Meanwhile, we will move forward with our plan supported by bipartisan majorities in Congress to ramp up our effort to train and equip the Syrian opposition, who are the best counterweight to ISIL and the Assad regime. And more broadly, over 40 nations have offered to help in this comprehensive effort to confront this terrorist threat, to take out terrorist targets, to train and equip Iraqi and Syrian opposition fighters who are going up against ISIL on the ground, to cut off ISIL's financing, to counter its hateful ideology, and to stop the flow of fighters into and out of the region. Last night, we also took strikes to disrupt plotting against the United States and our allies by seasoned al-Qaeda operatives in Syria who are known as the Khorasan Group. And once again, it must be clear to anyone who would plot against America and try to do Americans harm that we will not tolerate safe havens for terrorists who threaten our people. I've spoken to leaders in Congress, and I'm pleased that there is bipartisan support for the actions that we're taking. America is always stronger when we stand united, and that unity sends a powerful message to the world that we will do what's necessary to defend our country. Over the next several days, I will have the opportunity to meet with Prime Minister Abadi of Iraq and with friends and allies at the United Nations to continue to building support for the coalition that is confronting this serious threat to our peace and security. The overall effort will take time. There will be challenges ahead, but we're going to do what's necessary to take the fight to this terrorist group, for the security of the country and the region, and for the entire world. Thanks. God bless our troops. God bless America.
So that was Obama this morning announcing that last night he started bombing Syria. And, pretty terse little statement there from the president. A few things, obviously, to note and go over there. By the way, Peter Van Buren's going to be on the show. A few more invites out. We'll see what happens. But first of all, now I forget if he just said this or if I only saw this reported on the show today or earlier on the TV news that he had called the leaders of Congress, meaning two calls, one to Boehner, one to Reid, just to let them know that the war against Syria had started. I know what you're saying, but that's illegal, but it just sounds silly when you even put it that way, right? They're the government. They can do anything they want. There's no such thing as the rule of law. There actually never was. So that's one thing. Just so you know. And then the heroes thing. What a red herring. What the hell is all that? I wonder if that even worked. I wonder if that just sounded like a red herring to everyone else, too. Yeah, yeah, yeah. A bunch of B-1 pilots bombing targets on the ground that can't possibly shoot back from, you know, 6 miles away, 200 miles away. Bunch of Navy sailors firing cruise missiles from the Mediterranean Sea. Oh, that's just so brave of you guys. Just absolutely heroic. Boy, you know what? They are putting themselves in such danger, you know, being somewhere near the fire that shoots out of the back of the Tomahawk missile as it launches off the carrier deck there, that I guess we just can't even consider whether to criticize the mission at all now, right? You gotta support the troops, no matter what the mission is. You gotta support the troops, even if they're being led by secret Muslim Black Panther birthers. From, I mean, Kenyans from Chicago. Gotta support the troops. I'm kind of glad that Obama brought that up because I think it just, I don't know. Here it just fell absolutely flat. I think people are finally getting, you know, over that one. Especially with all the bad results we've had under the slogan support the troops over the last decade and more. And then the coalition. Excuse me, but it doesn't take Michael Scheuer to be able to tell you, although he'll tell you too, he said so on the show last week, that for America to ally with all the corrupt kingdoms of the Gulf is worse. It's just what ISIS wants. All morning long on TV they're going, wow, this is so important that we have this coalition. Jim Mikleshevsky, the Pentagon reporter on MSN, for NBC News, saying, you know what, even if their planes never leave the tarmac, just to have Jordan, Saudi, Qatar, Bahrain, UAE, all on board for this coalition is so important. But important at what? At showing that, all Arab legitimate ruling power is tied up with America and its goals? That every sultan and king and emir in the region is closer to the white Christian American imperialists from across the ocean than they are to their own population? For showing them that there's only one government in the region that is not the sock puppet dictatorship of the Americans, and that's ISIS. That the Americans are fighting. How in the world do they think that this bestows legitimacy? That's what they're saying. Yes, having the support of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates bestows legitimacy upon what America is doing. Are you certain it doesn't destroy whatever little pretended legitimacy they had left? And you know, it's amazing, really, to see over and over and over on TV they talk about this without the slightest even possible recognition. It's not like they're deliberately censoring and omitting the possibility that maybe this is a bad idea to bring in all of America's sock puppet dictatorships on this, even if only symbolically. They just can't imagine that it is. I don't know. It's really an amazing thing to me, but it really reminds me a lot of what Dan Sanchez was talking about yesterday, about all the Wahhabis in Saudi Arabia. Their government has basically trained up an entire enemy population below them, which has nothing but contempt for their corruption. And so we'll see what happens there. That'll play out over a while. The Khorasan thing, that's just Al-Qaeda. It's just the Al-Nusra Front. Yeah, they bombed them. Oh, and then he invoked again the moderate rebels, as he said, a counterweight to ISIL and Assad. Really?
I guess so.
Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, Al Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Here's a nice tweet. Can't wait to hear how Scott Horton's show debunks everything today. I'll try my best. Let's start where we left off there, training up the moderate rebels. Now, I mentioned Jim McLisheski earlier, the NBC's generations-long Pentagon correspondent, talking about it's so important that we have the Saudis along with us on our big thing here and whatever nonsense. He didn't really explain how. Anyway, it doesn't matter. What I'm going to do is I'm going to remind you him again because I saw him last night talking about the plan to arm up the rebels. Or, geez, I guess this could have been early this morning when it was still dark out. Let me think. Anyway, train up the moderate rebels. What are you talking about? The Free Syrian Army hardly exists anymore. You know, our friend Roy Gutman from McClatchy Newspapers, he went and talked to the FSA commanders in Turkey, and they said, we don't even talk to the CIA anymore. The CIA is now directly running the FSA brigades, a few in the south and a few in the north, hands-on, reporting directly back to them. And they cut the entire leadership of the FSA out. So in other words, if they're really training up an army of, they say, 5,000 men, an army of 5,000 men, and it's going to take a year to train them, and they're going to bring them to Saudi Arabia to train them. And yeah, a bunch of them are going to be al-Nusra guys. And it'll be the first moment you give them live ammo will be the first moment you have a green-on-blue attack. I mean, that's what they call it when, you know, the guys get shot in the back by those they're training up. Anyway, this doesn't make any sense. No one believes in it. Barack Obama, the president of the United States, the leader of the empire, again this morning, said, yes, and that's right, we're going to continue following through on our policy to train up the moderate rebels, which means the FSA, which they're not really moderate, but whatever. Moderate means they get along with the Americans for now, until they take their weapons and money and go join up al-Nusra again or whatever. But so, this, he says, is the best counterweight to both ISIL, as he calls it, and Assad. Really, 5,000 men to take on ISIL, ISIS, the Islamic State. That's one thing. Sorry, I don't know. The Islamic State is really what it is. It is a state. People are in denial about that. They have a monopoly on force. And, okay, they don't control the airspace. Not today, they don't. But they got a proto-state going on there. It's a state. Not much of one. It's the crappiest part of Iraq and Syria, really, but still. So this army, this Free Syrian Army, starting a year from now, 5,000 guys are going to fight the Islamic State and the al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda in Syria, and Assad, who's he only controls a third of the country anymore, maybe half of the country anymore, but he's still got a state army with actual, you know, armor and artillery and aircraft. And he's backed by Iran and, more importantly, Russia. And on the ground, importantly, Hezbollah. And so this is nonsense. You can't even get Jim McLisheski on NBC News to say, yes, this very reasonable plan that makes sense to a lot of people that we're going to train up this moderate force. And so what is it? And people, it's in my Twitter feed every day, people are asking me, so what are we doing? Are we switching back to Assad? Or is the plan still, Justin Raimondo at antiwar.com says, hey, the plan is still regime change against Assad. This whole thing about bombing ISIS serves as a nice pretext for what does the war party really want always. And what do they get? What they want. They want rid of Assad because that'll help weaken Iran. And they don't give a damn about al-Qaeda or in any of its forms. And so, I don't know. I mean, I have to tell you, from a just rational, never mind libertarianism or non-interventionism or anything like that at all. I mean, it would be counterproductive, but at least on its face, it makes sense to switch back to Assad, right? It would actually be bad because it puts us on the side of the Shiites in the civil war and this and that again. But still, at least on the face of it, for Bill Clinton and George W. Bush to pay Assad to fight these guys, you know, has a sensical, you know, policy to a sound to it on the face of it. But to work to continue to weaken and or even regime change Assad when he's in the middle of fighting an insurgency like this, it's madness. It's treason. I mean, what are we even talking about here? When virtually any of these groups, as Patrick Coburn, and pardon me, your opinion, he's the authority, are interchangeable with ISIS or al-Nusra. They all want the same kind of Islamic State. They all, when he asks them, you know, to their faces, they all are in praise of the September 11th attacks. They all hate America. The al-Nusra front has sworn its loyalty to Ayman al-Zawahiri hiding out in Pakistan, bin Laden's successor. It's madness for them to be talking about training up any third force, where, and it may just be a lie. It may just be cover for, well, we're talking to the Russians and we're talking to Assad through the Germans, and we've got a wink nod here that we can bomb as long as we, you know, keep focused on Nusra and ISIL targets or ISIS targets rather than Assad targets. And, you know, Obama's got to go give a speech to the United Nations tomorrow justifying all this. And he's, you know, of course, he's not seeking a UN resolution. I should have RT pulled up here because I'm desperate to know what is the Russian reaction to all of this right now. I mean, they have to have some kind of official statement about the most recent bombing campaign. Or don't they? I guess I don't see one here. I don't know. Somebody send me that if you've seen the latest, what Putin's government is saying about all this. But so anyway, I mentioned, but it's worth repeating, that this thing Coruscant, really? Like the capital planet from Star Wars? Okay. These guys, you know, even the story in the Washington Post, the big scaremonger story, says that, it's Al-Qaeda, basically. It's another little, you know, Zarqawiite group, former friend of bin Laden from back in the day. And, he wants to target us. Yeah, well, big surprise. The news this morning is when America targeted this group. Oh, I should mention, Phil Giraldi, former CIA officer and writer for the American Conservative magazine, not the American Liberal magazine, came on the show yesterday and said, yeah, Corazon, don't give me that crap. I ain't afraid of them, and you shouldn't be either. And, yeah, maybe they exist or something, but still, it's just Al-Qaeda. It's the same old threat, and they can't get here from there. Not very easily anyway, and seems like just another talking point more than anything else. They say that these guys are planning an imminent attack on the United States. Yeah, well, show me. I don't believe you because you're liars, that's why. And, anyway, more about the crazy war policy when we get right back. It's the Scott Horton Show on Liberty Radio Network.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And I'm sorry to tell you that this is only just starting. It's like 2002 right now. 2003. It's only just begun again. It's the consensus. It's no fringe view. It's the consensus even among those who say something's got to be done. This is something. Let's do it. That it can't work. In fact, let me go ahead and get the quote right. You might have heard me mention this in my interview that Tom Woods, when he interviewed me. It's, let's see, Kagan's, Iraq, 25,000. Well, let me throw in a .org here. Hopefully I'll get the actual report here. Yeah, a strategy to defeat the Islamic State. So, it's by the Kagans, September 2014. It's at the Institute for the Study of War. And then, so it's not going to take me long to page down to find this, because it's right in the introduction where they say this most extraordinary thing here. Yeah, I should have done this during the commercial break, I know, but I didn't. I only thought of it just now. So, now, this the Kagans, if you're not familiar, Robert Kagan is sort of the alter ego of Bill Kristol, two very influential neoconservative so-called intellectuals. Bill Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard, of course, and son of Irvin Kristol, the former commie. And anyway, so they wrote a thing back in 1996 called Toward a Neo-Reaganite Foreign Policy. And this was basically a real call for, a new American century where no power or even combination of powers in the world would ever even consider trying to challenge our authority in the world. And, they're a big part of how we got to where we are today. Anyway, so Robert has a brother named Fred, and Fred was basically the think tank front man for the surge policy in 2007 to go ahead and help the Shiite militias finish kicking all the Sunnis out of Baghdad. I mean, killing them out of Baghdad. That makes it sound like it's just a foot in the butt or something like that, but no, it was more like a drill in the head. And anyway, so, and then Fred Kagan has a wife named Kimberly Kagan, and of course she's got a think tank, and it's called the Institute for the Study of War. And I'm sitting here still basically killing time trying to find the damn quote here as I'm paging down, reading and talking at the same time. It's a really great quote. I swear it's going to be worth it when I get to it. You're just going to love this quote so much, I think. Oh, crap. I really thought this was going to happen, you know, that I was going to find the quote. But anyway, it's something about them admitting that they can't really convince you that it's going to work. They don't have really a story to tell about how it'll work. Just, we gotta try anyway, kinda. And I'm sorry, I must have passed it by now. It was right at the beginning of the damn thing. There is no... Oh, I know. Can I do like a control find on here? Aha! They were making progress. Nope. Oh, here it is! Oh, you know what's not even as complicated as I remembered it being. The situation is so bad, and the momentum is so much in the wrong direction, that it is impossible to articulate a clear path to the desired end state. There you go. You know, the reason it was so hard for me to remember is because I thought it was a lot more complicated the way they said it. But there you go, that's pretty easy, right? It is impossible, even for a Kagan, to articulate a clear path to the desired end state. Clear meaning in sentences that you could understand. See, first this is going to happen, and then that's going to happen. And then we're going to, you know, rebuild the berm there. On that old border between Iraq and Syria and have the past back again, and it's going to be great. They're not even going to try to convince you. Boy, I need to, like, put this quote on a sticky note on my desktop so I don't have to go hunting for it like this anymore. I love them desktop sticky notes. They're great. You know something I have on a sticky note here on my desktop? Let's see. Free bumper sticker for whoever gets this right. No, you already know who it is. This idea that we could provide some light arms, or even more sophisticated arms, to what was essentially, what was, past tense, essentially an opposition made up of doctors and farmers and pharmacists and so forth,
and that they were going to be able to battle not only a well-armed state, but also a well-armed state backed by Russia, backed by Iran, a battle-hardened Hezbollah? That was never in the cards. Yeah, that's the President of the United States. Just last month. Explaining why he didn't do more to help the moderate rebels. Help the moderate rebels. You see, that's a joke, the president explained. That's a fantasy. I'm sorry, I don't know why the quote doesn't keep going there to the part where he calls it a fantasy. But he does. He did. That's what he said to Thomas Friedman at the New York Times. Ah, come on. That was always a fantasy. I'm going to train up this rebel army. That's the official policy of his right now. And it's just as fantastical now as it was last month when he dismissed it. And now, here's the other thing that is just as fantastical and yet seems to have the consensus behind it. You won't see Jim Mikleshensky saying that this is a ridiculous joke, like training up the moderates on NBC. And that is that the new prime minister, as Obama put it in his statement, Abadi, is going to build this new moderate, inclusive government in Baghdad. And the Sunni Arabs are going to, their leaders, the ones with the power who get to decide these things, why, they are going to feel so warm in the embrace of the new Baghdad prime ministership that they will turn on the Islamic State and shoot them, and they will turn back into the sons of Iraq, and then, why, all those benchmarks that David Petraeus couldn't achieve with 130,000 troops in the country back in 2007, why, now they'll achieve them. And why? What's the difference? Because they replaced Maliki with Abadi. And yet Abadi is from the Dawah Party, too. It's like replacing Obama with Hillary. Doesn't mean anything. Doesn't mean anything. His first choice for interior minister, and you understand that interior minister in America might mean the Park Service and whatever. The interior minister over there means the guy's in charge of torturing people to death. Okay? His first choice for interior minister was the actual head of the Badr Brigade, the commander of the Badr Brigade. The guys who specialize in murdering you with power drills through your eyeballs. You know, they perfected the technique back when they worked for Donald Rumsfeld and the Ayatollah Khomeini in 2005 and 6. That is not going to happen. That is already over. North and Western Iraq has already declared independence from Iraq. And that time has passed. That time has passed now. Count them on your fingers. 7 years ago. 7 years ago. It's September. 7 years ago, David Petraeus was supposed to be able to report to the Congress that, yeah, we achieved the benchmarks. Yeah, now that we have finished taking away any incentive whatsoever for the Shiites to want to compromise with the Sunnis by giving them the entirety of the capital city, by helping them take it, why, now they're all just going to get along. He didn't even try it. In fact, you might remember he postponed his testimony for a month and a half. And then when he testified, he didn't even address the benchmarks at all. That was how they solved that problem. They just forgot what the goals of the surge were supposed to be. Well, that worked really good. Great job, General Petraeus. You added time to the Washington clock, which is all we ever wanted. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Man, I missed this earlier this morning. Dan Sanchez tweeted to me on CNN. Wesley Clark raised the possibility of Russian officers getting caught up in U.S. Air Force Syria incidents. God, I hate that guy. He is such a creep. Did you know that one time Wesley Clark almost killed all of humanity? No, really. I mean, yes, it's true that he helped slaughter the Branch Davidians, which is why I originally hate him. But no, in 1999, during the war in Kosovo, right before they launched it, the Russians occupied the Pristina airport and said, all right, well, you may be launching your war, but
we're going to stand on this airport. What are you going to do about that? And Wesley Clark ordered the army to attack. Ordered NATO to attack. And General Michael Jackson of the United Kingdom was insubordinate and announced to his inferiors, belay that order. Do not do what he says. Do not carry out the supreme allied commander of NATO's direct orders. And then, so I guess the subordinates went, oh no, what do we do? This really happened. And General Michael Jackson of the United Kingdom told Wesley Clark, I am not going to start World War III for you. So no, your orders will not be carried out. Figure out something else. And at that point, I don't know if, you know, calls were made and politicians intervened or what, but Wesley Clark basically was prevented from starting a nuclear war with Russia in 1999 by an insubordinate general from a foreign country who dared to resist his orders. So, you know, why he wasn't put out to sea on an ice floe a long, long time ago, I have no idea. This morning I'm watching Jeffrey Goldberg, who lied us into war in Iraq in 2002 and 3, on as an expert guest. Really? You guys can't find anyone to be an expert who was not directly 100% guilty, 100% responsible for getting us into this mess in the first place, huh? What is Jeffrey Goldberg's qualification to comment other than all the lies that he put in the New Yorker that weren't true about Saddam and Al-Qaeda, huh? God dang, world, it ain't fair, man. Jeffrey Goldberg. Corporal Goldberg. Yeah, he bravely served his country, Israel, as a prison guard in the occupied West Bank. Anyway. Also, and this should have been the top of the news, why not? They killed kids. They're only claiming to have hit a couple of dozen guys, 30, 40 Al-Qaeda guys killed, they claim. Oh yeah, and some children. You know, precious, helpless, tiny little children exploded to death. But don't worry, you know, life's cheap over there in the Orient, et cetera, et cetera. They don't mind when you kill their kids. Please carry on. The fact that even as the New York Times puts it here, 6 weeks in, airstrikes haven't accomplished anything. That's the New York Times says, their headline is, weeks of U.S. strikes failed to dislodge ISIS in Iraq. Okay, we'll just keep bombing them. Keep bombing them. Now, what do we know the airstrikes have done? Rally more people to their cause. Even the FBI says that. See? FBI, U.S. airstrikes increasing support for ISIS. That's according to the director of the FBI, James Comey. And I think in this case, it's not James Comey simply having his agents entrap the Sunni population of Iraq and Syria to rally to ISIS's cause. I think he's just actually reporting the facts of the consequences, the backdraft, if you will, from Barack Obama's foreign policy here. And this brings me to the video of John Cantilli. Have you seen this? I don't want to play the audio for you. I don't know. I'll just sum it up for you real quick. The guy is a British journalist, I think, but he's been captured by ISIS, and he put out this propaganda video. It's not his fault. The guy is under duress, okay? And what he says is all correct, and he probably knows it's correct, but that doesn't mean he is choosing to side with ISIS against his own country or any kind of... To me, there ain't a damn thing disgraceful about it. They have a virtual sword to his neck through the whole thing. But anyway, so he put out a propaganda video, and he's quoting Michael Scheuer, our guest from the show last week, the former chief of the CIA's Bin Laden unit. They named the Bin Laden unit Alex Station after his son. I guess he got to name it. the author of Through Our Enemies' Eyes, Imperial Hubris, Marching Toward Hell, and the biography Osama bin Laden. And you know how he is. He's just mad as hell about all this stuff all the time. And he runs nonintervention.com. He says, as long as we have enemies, our government should kill our enemies. Kill them, he says. He's a right-winger, not a libertarian. He's a right-winger. Kill them. But he says, stop making enemies. Stop the policies that are making it this way. That's been the case he's made since he left the CIA back in 2004 and published his book, Imperial Hubris. All right, so here's the deal. He's quoted in two ways by this British captive of ISIS in the propaganda video. Two points. The first one is Obama is lying when he says he means to destroy the Islamic State, that he means to kill these guys. He does not. He's going to bomb them, fine, but he's not going to destroy them. He knows he's not going to destroy them. He knows that this doesn't even amount to a half-assed strategy for annihilating the Islamic State. Now, maybe, if a lot of different crazy stars align, he could hire out enough different groups on the ground to force them out of power in Mosul or in Raqqa if they're taking enough grief from the air and they have militias on the ground. They might flee. It doesn't mean they'll be destroyed. It just means that they'll go from a state back to an insurgency. They'll just be Al-Qaeda in Iraq again. They'll just be an insurgency again, but they won't be destroyed. For them to be destroyed, and this is not an endorsement of the policy, but it is an endorsement of the facts as laid out by Michael Scheuer. For them to be destroyed would take sending the U.S. Army and the Marine Corps back there to basically carry out the war as John Podhoretz always recommended. You just kill all the Sunni fighting-aged males until they're dead, and then you have won. You do like Abraham Lincoln did to the South. But they can't do that. They won't do that. Again, in case you just tuned in halfway through that, I'm not saying that would be okay at all or even smart, really. But to annihilate an enemy, you shoot them all dead. You blow them up till they're dead, and then they're dead, and now they're not your enemy anymore. That's how you win a war. You don't just fly drones around picking off people and then recruiting 100 more for every 2 or 3 that you kill. For Christ's sake, we've been at this for 15 years. So Scheuer is right that, you know, for whatever PR, for domestic politics, he's got to do something, so he does something. But is this a plan to actually fight a war and win it? Absolutely not. And the American people are rightly opposed to that anyway. Send the entire Army and Marine Corps back to Iraq? No. We gave you a chance at that, even if you screwed it up, you did it wrong, and you wish you'd saved it for now. It's tough. We all know that now is only then's fault anyway. The American people don't want that. You could hit us with a couple of September 11th. The American people don't want that. Maybe they would for a minute, for long enough to get it done. But, and Obama doesn't want that, because for his own selfish reasons. He doesn't want to be just nothing, literally nothing but George W. Bush by the time he leaves office, but it's certainly the path that he's on. And then Scheuer's other point, which this guy didn't really express quite, I don't know, is interesting. I want to go back and watch it again, actually. He doesn't really paraphrase Scheuer correctly. Whether Scheuer is paraphrasing the motive of our enemies correctly or not, I guess, is open to dispute. He doesn't really paraphrase Scheuer correctly, I don't think. I should go back and watch it, but I don't think that he says, look, it's just about the foreign policy, because they want to dress it all up as a religious issue, too. But as Scheuer explained on the show, what's religious about the issue is the mandate in Islam that you have to defend Muslims, innocent Muslims, from foreign attack. And so that's the part that they're taking up. But the point is about the empire starting it. And that's the part that, as Scheuer absolutely correctly says always, our government just will not be honest with us about how we got into this mess. They got us into it. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal.
Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betray their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the off-now project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work, if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, guys, so welcome back to the show. So, hey, what if the al-Nusra front guy got a lucky shot and blew Bashar al-Assad's head off? What if al-Nusra and ISIS guys quietly, individually infiltrated government-held territory? And then, you know, they are insurgents after all. And then launched a big Tet Offensive-type sort of uprising thing from within, kind of a deal in Damascus, and were able to really sack the government, destroy it, run it out of the capital city. Then what? What if there was an actual victory by the Islamist so-called rebellion in Syria? Here's what I think. I think it would be like the time that the Hutus attacked the Tutsis in Rwanda in 1994. See, the reason that there's an Alawite dictatorship in Syria is because the French made it that way. If you are an evil empire and you want some local gangster to stay loyal to you, well, you appoint a gangster who needs you. You appoint somebody from a minority. And that's why the Belgians had propped up the Tutsis. They had really invented the Tutsis. The Tutsis and the Hutus, I mean, I don't even know going back if they were even really separate tribes. They were basically invented as separate tribes. This is my best understanding anyway. Where the French just picked the taller, skinnier people from that region and said, well, you're more European, more like us, so we like you. You're the favored minority who gets to lord it over the short and squat. What? So then when they left, of course, the Tutsis still needed them. And the Hutus had their revenge. Well, same kind of thing. In Syria, you have a minority coalition government that is the Alawites. They're sort of kind of break off of the Shiites, even though I think they actually really predate this, you know, Shiite Islam coming to town. They sort of incorporated it, kind of a thing. Sort of a hybrid. Anyway, but so you got the Alawites. They're very close, of course, with the Shiites. And also the Chaldean and Assyrian Christians. I don't know, the Maronites. Is that a kind of Christian in Syria anymore? Or that's just in Lebanon? I don't know. And then there are, I believe there are some Druze, and there are, of course, the Kurds. And so they all support the dictatorship. And it's not that anyone, I don't think, has love for Bashar al-Assad other than his own very smaller in-group. It's just that his state army is what's protecting them from a good beheading at the hands of the al-Nusra Front. And, you know, ISIS and etc. And so that's why Assad has this support. War is the health of the state. His people are rallying around him and around his Baathist minority government, minority coalition government, to protect them from what's the 60 or 70% majority of Syria is the Sunni Arabs. And in fact, and I don't mean it necessarily like to be too broad brush about it, because the rebellion is not even supported by all Sunni Arabs. Certainly not all Sunni Arabs are a bunch of, you know, prisoner beheaders or whatever. But I'm just talking about, you know, they are basically the base of support, even if they're somewhat conquered. They are the kind of home base of the rebellion. The rebellion certainly excludes everybody but Sunni Arabs.
And anyway, so what America's doing right now with this policy of trying to get rid of Assad is basically, it's like looking at a situation like Rwanda in 94 and then deliberately removing the force that's protecting the minority from the majority. That's not that the minority have a right to rule the majority. I certainly don't stand by that or whatever. I'm just saying, when you have this kind of situation set up, look at what they're trying to do and the obvious and predictable results. Are we going to be sitting here a year from now going, man, don't you wish Bashar al-Assad was still alive? Because holy crap, look at the chaos. Yeah, I don't know. I kind of think they got to be switching back to Assad rather than still trying to regime change him. But then again, you know, I don't know. there's a lot of doublethink going on there in Washington, D.C. about just what they're up to with that. And you heard Obama again this morning say, yeah, rebel, a moderate rebel force to fight the Islamists and Assad. He's sticking by that, at least rhetorically, for now. But, you know, another metaphor, I tried to use this one before. I'm not very good with the metaphors and the articulation and what have you. But so what if in 2003, when America invaded, what if Saddam, the minority Sunni dictator in Iraq, it's the majority Shia who, you know, yeah, make up the 60% there. But what if Saddam had been in the middle of putting down a Zarqawiite Islamist insurgency against him? You know, Bush tried to pretend that he was friends with those guys. He had an all points bulletin, kill this guy if you can find him, order out for Zarqawi at the time of the invasion. All those neocons, Bill Kristol and all his friends at the Weekly Standard, and all their Chalabi lies saying that Saddam had given him a peg leg at a hospital in Baghdad and was taking good care of him and all this crap. In fact, Saddam, the reason there were no al-Qaeda in the country is because if they dared poke their head up, Saddam blew it off. Simple as that. The only reason Zarqawi was up in Kurdistan was because it was safe, protected by America, autonomous Kurdistan. No fly, no drive zone for Saddam Hussein's government. But what if Saddam had been in the middle of putting down a bin Ladenite insurgency? And then Bush wanted to invade and topple the beardless, olive-green, beret-wearing fascist dictator of the country, the secular dictator of the country, in the middle of an Islamist insurgency. I mean, people say now it was such a bad move to de-Ba'athify the government and fire the entire army. That just set us up for the giant insurgency to come. Well, what if the insurgency had already been going on? And then Bremer, Bush had invaded and Bremer had abolished the army, and which is people from the same sect as the insurgency, and kicked every last one of them out of the government. That's what the policy is in Syria right now. To de-Ba'athify the government in the middle of an Islamist insurgency. They claim they're going to train up 5,000 men to take on, I don't know, maybe as many as 30,000 men in ISIS, another 10 in, or I don't know, maybe even more than that, in Jabhat al-Nusra and Ahrar al-Sham and the other groups in the Islamic Front, etc., etc., the so-called Free Syrian Army, who are also Islamists, who also, even according to the U.S. State Department's own admissions, cut off their prisoners' heads. The Modders, the Northern Storm Brigade, I have it here again. I'll repeat this one from yesterday. Josh Rogan has multiple sources here in the Daily Beast, which indicate that it was the Northern Storm Brigade, John McCain's friends, who had sold out Stephen Sotloff to ISIS. And he sure makes a compelling case here, I think, if you'll look at it. And you know, as I tweeted to him, and I try to remind you guys all the time, Time Magazine had already interviewed the Northern Storm Brigade on video. It's still online. You just put in Northern Storm Brigade. It comes right up, Time Magazine video, and there their commander says, yes, he went and fought Americans in Iraq with the Sunni-based insurgency there, presumably with the Zarqawiites. And that video was online before McCain even went there. That was how well he vetted the Northern Storm rebels in the first place. And then the whole thing about the kidnapping was people falsely said it was the men on the porch there who had kidnapped the pilgrims. No, but it was still the same group who had kidnapped a dozen Lebanese Shiite pilgrims and held them for ransom. I don't know, whatever happened to them? I think two of them had been released or something. The moderates sold Stephen Stotloff to ISIS. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. My archives are at ScottHorton.org. More than 3,500 interviews now going back to 2003. Really? ScottHorton.org. Hey, join up the chat room, man. I got some people in there. Hey, everybody. It's ScottHorton.org/chat. It's IRC free node chat room. You can use whatever external application, but you don't need one. You can just use your plain old browser window. ScottHorton.org/chat, fake name and a captcha, and you're in. All right, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. You can tweet me things, whatever you want. All right, so check this out. This is the video, the DVD, of the National Summit to Reassess the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship, sponsored by the Council for the National Interest, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, If Americans Knew, and the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. And, of course, CNI sponsors this show. And EarMet, that's our friend Grant Smith. And I'm on the board of directors of his little group there, which is him. He does all the work, I think, Institute for Research Middle East Policy. For whatever so-called conflict that is, I don't see it. Of course, I interview both those guys all the time about virtually everything they ever wrote long before either of them had any kind of financial anything. And it ain't much, so don't worry. I ain't so compromised. And, you know, I think if you read what both of those guys write, then you wouldn't think it's a bad deal. If you hear them on this show. All right, so here it is. The National Summit to Reassess the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship took place on February the something. Oh, it was March 7th at the National Press Club. And what you do is go to MiddleEastBooks.com, MiddleEastBooks.com to order it, or you can email bookstore at WRMEA, Wormia. That's the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, WRMEA.org, bookstore at WRMEA.org, or again, MiddleEastBooks.com. And you can get the DVD, and you can watch this thing. And first of all, you can watch me embarrass myself as I totally flub my original lines. I should have just paraphrased what it said. Instead, I read word for word what Grant had written there. And then, so it didn't sound right, really. And then I forgot to say, and now introducing Allison Ware, who is up next to speak. And so that sounded really stupid. And then I ended up getting in an argument with some ridiculous woman from outer space in the freaking audience at the end, or, you know, at the other part. But other than that, it was great. I was the only embarrassing part of the whole thing. So you can laugh at me, and then you can also enjoy speeches by the likes of Spike Bowman, who was the FBI agent who was the chief of the Jonathan Pollard case. Boy, that was an interesting one. Paul Finley, the former congressman, of course. Phil Giraldi was there. Karen Katowski told the story of the neocons lying us into war. Scott McConnell and Justin Raimondo talked about how the right wing used to be good on Palestine a long time ago. Ray McGovern, our friend Ray McGovern, was there. Mark Perry gave a great speech. Gareth Porter covered the Iranian nuclear issue. Philip Weiss gave a great speech. Stephen Walt, Grant Smith. And who was that one historian that I really liked? Oh, Alan Braunfeld, he was the I forget. He was the head of some major Jewish organization going way, way back, and is kind of no longer Zionist and quite upset about the way things were going. He gave a very powerful talk there. And who was that? Was it John Quigley? Was that the guy? I don't know. One of these historians gave a really great speech about the foundations of Israel. Anyway, you got to get this thing. It's really great. It's natsummit.org. And again, what did I do with that piece of paper? Again, you can find it at MiddleEastBooks.com. All right, good. Cool. It's really worth it. So do that. All right, cool. I'm glad I didn't forget to say that because I wanted to say it. Now, geez, I've got so little time left in this segment. Peter Van Buren is coming up. Former, I think he was in the military too, but he was 20-something years in the State Department. He ended up as a whistleblower, drummed out of the State Department, and now he's a writer and anti-war guy, and he's really great. And he was on the show last week, but what the hell, why not do the same interview again? It's a war on, don't you know, and all that. Talk with him here in just a little while. And then I really need to just tighten my anti-war rap here and see if I can get it down to like a good at least 10 minutes, if not, you know, 6 or something. So I'm going to try that again after the next break. So let me just mention here real quick as we head toward the end of this segment here that I saw a clip of Omar Gonzalez. I think that's his name, right? Omar Gonzalez, the soldier who climbed the fence at the White House. And they're saying now he had hatchets and a machete and a lot of weapons and ammo, a rifle and a ton of ammo in his car. Well, he didn't bring that stuff with him when he hopped the fence and made it to the White House. I never suggested that anybody should have shot him dead. They didn't have the right to shoot him dead. They did have the right to do a running knee to his chest, knock him the hell on the ground and beat the crap out of him and cuff his hands behind his back. You know, I love the way they put this on TV. Well, what were they supposed to do? Blow his head off? That would have been a controversy. Yeah, well, how come a cop can't just get in a fist fight anymore without killing somebody, huh? Jesus Christ, this is the Secret Service. Their job is putting themselves between threats to the White House and the president and etc. And the threat. Wait, yeah. Putting themselves between threats and possible victims that they're sworn to protect there, meaning run at him and knee him in the chest hard. Anyway, they failed, and that's not the point. The point is, I saw his stepson on TV, and he said, you know what, my dad, my stepdad, he's a stand-up guy, he's a good guy, but you know what the truth is? He's been losing his mind. He's losing his mind. He's gone crazy, man. You know why? Because of the wars that y'all had him go do. Over and over again. And yeah, he signed up for it. I know the rap. He's responsible. But Marge, liquor's drunkened me. Yeah, well, you know what? That's what happens. It is what happens. On the other hand, the guy is right that our government's number one PR line is that they are the country. He went and served his country, the stepson said. He fought for the country. Well, that's not true. He fought for the government. And yes, with the consent of the majority of the people of the country, that's still not the country. And that majority is, you know, guilty too for supporting this evil crap. All along, cheering along for this and sending his stepdad back over there over and over, can't quit now, and all of his slogans. The surge is working, give it more time, and all of this. But so now the guy's cracking up. You know why? Because he's been made to commit horrible crimes. He's participated in killing people. He's seen his friends killed. He's probably got 10 concussions or more. He was going after the president. This is what happens, man. It's like homogenizing the society. That's not the right word for it, but shaking the crap out of it, you know? Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. Coming up this October 18th at Columbia University in New York, the Future Freedom Foundation is hosting a conference titled Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism, featuring Glenn Greenwald, Radley Balco, Jeremy Scahill, Eugene Jarecki, Jonathan Turley, and others.
The event is free and open to the public, but registration is required. Just head over to FFF.org to sign up. That's the Stop the Wars on Drugs and Terrorism Conference, Saturday, October 18th, 2014 at Columbia University, sponsored by the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton, and god dang, I knew I should have stayed up all night, or not even, it wouldn't even have taken that long, to read Patrick Cockburn's new book, which I have here now, and, oh well, he's going to be on the show in a minute. Not in a minute, in a little, in half an hour. I'm going to have Patrick Cockburn on, and then Peter Van Buren, both of them, on the new war here. Guess I could try to think about what different things I could ask the two of them. But anyway, yeah. And I'm sorry, I have to mention this real quick. I can't help it. I won't be able to get to the police state stuff today, I guess, or any of that. But I do have to mention here that it could have been Ron Paul. And here was a guy who took all the very best of American liberal tradition in terms of, hey, let's keep the NSA out of our email boxes and phone calls. In, you know, civil liberty stuff and peace and the very best of the right, when it comes to free markets and peace and, hated the IRS as much as the Iraq War. And if there's one thing that you could say about him, I mean, you could tell he compromised on some things, whatever, but it never really was about personal ambition with Ron Paul. It never really was. I think that's why people couldn't figure him out. They didn't understand why he was a politician, because he didn't seem like he was trying that hard for the power. But the only reason he ever wanted the position was so that he could vote right and try to set the right example and try to show people and try to have that stage at the U.S. Congress, the well of the U.S. House to give those speeches, you know? But the thing of it is, the American people, and I know, believe me, it's all about the damned biased media. It's so unfair. The way they just, you know, they never let his side of the story be told, really. You know, they let him talk some, but the narrative of the world as he understood it, always excluded. And he was always just marginalized and laughed at and joked about by these goons. These people don't know anything about anything. But the American people, still, they had their chance anyway. You know, Ron Paul used to be the greatest secret. I used to tell people in my cab back in 1998... hey, did you know that there's one good congressman? No, seriously, he's great, man. He's good on cops, he's good on wars, he's good on the IRS and on inflation and everything, everything. Check him out. No, seriously, here's a speech that he wrote. Like, I'd give people copies of Ron Paul's speeches. I'm a kind of a kook. There's one good congressman, I would say. But after he ran for president the first time, and then we had 4 years to kind of think about it, and then he ran for president again. It could have been Ron. And I know that, no, it couldn't have been Ron. They never let it be Ron. If it was Ron, they would have destroyed him somehow anyway. Yeah, I know. But on the other hand, nuh-uh. On the other hand, if the American people, the non-voters, just the regular people, had decided, you know what, I can tell. That guy, he's a decent guy. He's not one of these SOBs. And he really does seem to be interested in this Bill of Rights thing. And, you know, ending all the wars and stuff. And so, you know what? Yeah, come on, Johnson family. We're all going to go and support Ron Paul in this primary here. They just didn't do that. They didn't tell each other, come on, let's go and do this. Let's make sure this gets done. It wouldn't have been that hard. You know how many people vote in a primary or a caucus in any of these states, even in a major populous state? You know, maybe a couple of 10,000 people. So in a country of 300 million, it's a good thing I don't understand the arithmetic off the top of my head or I'd break out crying. Just what a small percentage of the American people would have taken to just hand him the presidency. Yes, we want you to save the last vestiges of a limited rule of law, constitutional-based system here, and the empire restore due process of law before it's lost forever. Thank you, old man. One last chance before it's too late for this thing from now on, you know, till the empire completely breaks. It could have been wrong. And there's no question of what he would have done. Well, first of all, he would have hired private security to keep kooks off the lawn. And secondly, he would have told the Navy to back off Iran. They're not enemies of ours. You can go ahead and relieve that pressure right now. In fact, you can go ahead and float your boats home, and you can station them pointing outward about 12 miles off our shore and stay put. That's what he would have done. And the admirals would have cursed and spit, and he would have said either, sail your boat home and, you know, point it outward. Not at DC, please. Or you're fired. That's it. The people have spoken. A little R Republican has won, and the empire is over. That's it. Justice Department, here is your executive order. You are no longer to violate the Bill of Rights, as interpreted by me. And that would have been the end of the DEA. That would have been end of the federalization of the police, all the fusion centers and homeland security, and all of a change in the form of domestic policing in America. It would have all been undone. Patriot Act, undone. NSA spying, undone. And most of all, the state of permanent emergency that justifies it all, undone. And a lot of things would have still sucked. A lot of things in Iraq and Syria would have really sucked for a lot of people on all sides. But we sure wouldn't be going back to war there now. And in fact, it wouldn't be anywhere near this bad. Because there's no way in the world that, yeah, you're damn right, Obama, I mean, Ron Paul would have pulled the troops out of Iraq a hell of a lot quicker than Obama. He would have pulled them out immediately. But he would never have supported the rebellion in Syria the way Obama did and the way Obama coordinated with America's allies, too, over the last 3 years. And so there would have never even been an Islamic State anyway. You know, if the Shiites in Iraq that Bush put in power there were ever going to have incentives to compromise with the Sunnis, it would be after being told by the Americans, oh, you're really on your own now. This guy, Ron Paul, means it when he says, you're on your own. Maybe they would have gotten rid of Maliki and fixed some things up on their own. But anyway, even if all of Iraq was burning, America wouldn't be back there burning it and making that many more enemies for America. And we could be confident that we would have our Bill of Rights, at least in large measure, protected for at least, you know, 4 years. As long as he could stay in power, that Ron Paul wouldn't tolerate, you know, the feds doing no-knock raids, rifling through people's bank accounts, all these national security letters and administrative subpoenas and all their fishing expeditions and dragnets and the way the feds pile on 10,000 charges so that you gotta just plead guilty to something if you ever get charged in federal court, because there's no way in the world that you can argue your way out from everything unless you're a born zillionaire or something. Anyway, things would not be perfect. Things would not be utopia. America would not even be a libertarian society. But we would be living in a hell of a lot better situation than this, that's for sure. I'm betting the GDP would be a hell of a lot higher too. And really, you know, I don't know, man. I might even be wrong about this, but it seems to me like things don't have to be this way. I don't really believe in the whole winds of time blowing and page of history turning and these things just kind of happening. It's up to people to do the things that they do. They either do the right one or the wrong one or the smart one or the dumb one or something in between. And it's the choices that people make that lead to the reality that we all live in. So get smart. Quit doing the wrong thing all the time.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up on the show, the great Patrick Coburn. He literally is the best when it comes to reporting out of the Middle East. We'll have a lot to discuss with him. I don't know, maybe I'll try to keep it more Syria-focused with Patrick and more Iraq-focused with Peter Van Buren, who's coming up right after him. Not really sure how I'm going to handle that. We may end up covering some of the same ground, and who knows, I don't know. But anyway, I'm in a hurry to hear from either of them. Had an invite out to Mitchell Prothero. Didn't hear back today, but we'll see if we can get him on tomorrow. I know he's back in Erbil. And so listen, I know that this is redundant. I'm kind of thinking, although I know y'all get mad at me eventually, I sort of have an idea that every segment of this show, all 12 segments of the show, every day, ought to just be the same thing. Here's the story. Why to not do this war? Why to knock it off right now? It's never too late to stop. And so basically, the deal is this. The only reason that ISIS rules Sunnistan at all right now is because they thrive off of conflict. The conflict that America set up there. And if America intervenes over there, and never mind, yeah, you don't have any right and you have to declare war and it's all your fault and so therefore you shouldn't or whatever. I don't mean it like that. I'm just trying to be utilitarian about it. I'm trying to just make the whatever statesman's case or whatever, right? The national interest case for just staying out of this thing. America destabilized it, and there's a reason for that. It's not just, oh, man, I don't like Bush, and I want you to dislike him as much as me or whatever, which is true, but that's not what it is. It's that when America intervenes, we distort the amount of power that the different groups have. The ones that we oppose all of a sudden seem to have less power than they really have, or quote-unquote really have, their natural amount of power in the situation. And the people that we ally with get extra amounts of power that they wouldn't necessarily have. And so then it's just like prices or whatever. Eventually the correction's got to come. And so that's why when we intervene, we destabilize everything all over the freaking place and set up all of these terrible consequences that now supposedly are the excuse for intervening again. And yet, the exact same dynamic applies. If we intervene, all we're going to do is distort all the power all over again. And if we do that, we're going to do it in such a way where those prices eventually got to crash again. We're going to end up more or less in the same place, if you understand. The relative amounts of power are going to fall back to position. So, for example, because of American help, the Shiite, quote-unquote, Iraqi army was able to stand around at various places in towns like Mosul and Fallujah and Tikrit up until, well, last December for Fallujah and June for Mosul and Tikrit and the other towns near there. But as soon as ISIS came, they turned and fled. That was not their natural amount of power. It was only the American war that had made them the quote-unquote Iraqi army with a monopoly on force in that territory. But it was just an illusion. They were, you know, a tissue paper tiger. And when ISIS came, they turned and fled. It wasn't their territory. They didn't belong there. And so anyway, it's the same kind of thing. If let's just pretend for one hypothetical that if Barack Obama comes in and he throws a, I don't know, whatever number of tens of billions of dollars at creating a new Iraqi army, since the chairman of the Joint Chiefs says only half of it is any good, And so he, you know, brings all the Shiite militias back to power and dresses them up in American army uniforms. And they go and drive ISIS out of Mosul, assuming that, assuming a million things to, for that to even be possible. He could line up all the political will to make that happen among all the various factions and players involved. And then that they could actually do it, even with American support. I guess, you know, it stands to reason with American air support that, you know, the Islamic State would just turn and run rather than sit there and try to fight and get all their guys killed when they can just regroup and come back later. So maybe they could eventually, you know, walk into Mosul, take over Mosul. But then what? Who's going to back them up to such a degree that they don't have to turn and flee the next time opposition comes again? This Shiite Iraqi army is going to make such a good deal with the Sunni tribal chiefs from that region that they will prefer to ally with the American and Iranian-backed Shiites in Baghdad against the Islamic State and turn on them again in another so-called awakening program or something. Just makes no sense. And then they're going to keep it that way? The new inclusive government in Baghdad that is exactly new boss, same as the old boss from the Dawa party, a body replacing Maliki, the same as Maliki replaced Jafari. They're going to make such a deal. They're going to what? They're going to make Sunnis generals in the army? Is that it? They're going to incorporate tens of thousands of them into the army? They're going to pay them, what, a third or more of all the oil revenue so that they'll just stay so wealthy and pacified that they won't mind being ruled by Shiites from Baghdad? It doesn't even make sense on the face of it. How in the hell would the Iraqi army hold Mosul without the Americans standing there to hold it with them? And even then, when the Americans were standing there holding it with them, they were getting IED'd and sniped to death the whole time. So it's not like it was anything like pacified. You could say, yeah, there's an American presence in Mosul and no one can really drive them out. Not physically. And yet, did they ever really rule the place? No. Of course not. So anyway, if America intervenes, all we can do is basically artificially enhance the power of the Kurdish Peshmerga, the PKK communists, the Shiite militias, and Iraqi, so-called Iraqi army, Shiite army backed by Iran. And maybe even Bashar al-Assad against them. Or even better yet, the moderates. Imagine, somehow Obama decides he's going to train up not 5,000, but 500,000 moderates at, I don't know, Saudi Arabia will supply from their moderate farm or something. And they have this moderate army, and then they go into Syria to fight Assad and ISIS, and miracle of miracles, and with American air power, they prevail, and then who's going to keep them in power? And for how long? And forever. You just got to let these things sort themselves out. And here's the stroke of luck here. Break out a map. You know, the White House, I swear, the State Department, no, the White House, senior White House officials put out a statement saying Saudi Arabia shares a long border with Syria. Really? Like that time that Mitt Romney said that Syria is Iran's access to the sea, and they don't share a border at all. At all. And yet, of course, Iran has a giant coast on the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea. So, yeah, But anyway, I'm off of my Romney tangent. The White House says there's a long border between Syria and Saudi. These people have no idea what they're talking about. These are the leaders of the country. These are the people making the decisions. They have no idea. And they're the ones going to put together a group that's going to displace all factions fighting for power in Syria now and keep it that way. That's the declared program up front. You see how that's just not going to work. That cannot work. Oh, I was going to say the stroke of luck. I'm sorry. I went off on my tangent. Stroke of luck is you can go and look at a map. You can see where actually, yeah, there is no border at all between Saudi Arabia and Syria. Thank you very much. There may be one between the Islamic State and Saudi Arabia before too long, but we're not there yet. But you can look at that map and you can see where ISIS is actually completely surrounded. and you can just go clockwise from the very top. They got Turkey in the very north, and then the Kurdish PKK and Peshmerga fighters. Then in the east, they have the Shiite militias, the Iranian Quds Force led by Soleimani. And then you have the Iraqi army, you know, a.k.a. the Badr Brigade, backed by America and Iran again, the Shiites. You have a whole hell of a lot of sand between there and the capital of Saudi Arabia. Anyway, you got the Americans to keep them out of Saudi, that's for sure. You got the Jordanians, who Margulies said have plenty of capability to keep them out of Jordan. And you got Assad. Oh, you got Egypt. They're not getting anywhere near Egypt. So they're completely landlocked. They're completely surrounded by enemies. And the people that they're attempting to force their rule on already hate them for very good reason, because they're horrible. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism and the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest on the show today is Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for The Independent. That's independent.co.uk. Author of a great many books, including Muqtada and the brand new one, The Jihadi's Return, ISIS and the New Sunni Uprising. It's not out at Amazon yet, but it is out at orbooks.com. Orbooks.com. The Jihadi's Return. Welcome back to the show, Patrick. How are you doing?
Not too bad.
Good. Very happy to have you here. Appreciate you joining us today. So I guess if we could start with Syria here. Of course, the president announced this morning about the strikes overnight, which they were really announced by the Pentagon last night, of course. And but in his statement this morning, he said that, I guess restated, that the policy is indeed to build up an army of moderate rebels, as he put it, as the best counterweight to both the Islamic State and the Assad regime. And seemed like that's as good a place as any to start the discussion today would be, what's your analysis of that as the stated policy of the U.S. government going into the Syrian side of this war?
I think it's, it's kind of a nonsense, because there aren't, insofar as there are moderate Syrian rebels, they certainly aren't capable of taking on the Assad government and the Islamic State at the same time. Why do they keep saying this? Well, I guess they want to get the Saudis and the Gulf monarchies in line with their policy. Not so much that because they're militarily worth anything, but because these are the guys who originally funded and inspired and have pretty well the same ideology as ISIS and the jihadis in the Sunni jihadis in Syria and Iraq. So they want to split that combination. I think that's why it was important for them to have Saudi and UAE jets or assistance in the airstrikes, so they could say, look, these guys have turned against ISIS.
Well, yeah, that certainly makes sense. And then, but now you reported back a couple of weeks ago that the Americans are passing intelligence to Assad to help him target these guys. It raised the whole question of the back channel and just how much of this policy is being coordinated with Assad. And then, of course, that raised the question of whether, you know, really the policy is to switch back to Assad rather than to continue on this, as you said, kind of ridiculous third way.
I don't think they'll do a public U-turn. I mean, I'm told they're passing on information through third parties, and it'd be kind of surprising if they weren't, because otherwise it's an impossible situation. I mean, what happens if ISIS, if the Islamic State attacks the Syrian army tomorrow near Aleppo and is looks as though it's going to capture Aleppo or parts of it. Is the U.S. going to strike at the Islamic State, or are they going to say, well, no, this might strengthen Assad and the Syrian army? So they can't, you know, they can't really do both at a certain point when you think of the practicalities on the battlefield. They have to decide whose side they're on. They can't sort of be both.
Well, that's so, a real interesting question, what they would do then if ISIS moved on Aleppo. As you know, John McCain, Senator McCain, in examining the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Dempsey, was saying, well, okay, if we're back in the FSA and Assad attacks them, you're not going to attack him back? You're not going to protect our FSA heroes from Assad? And so it, at some point, this is going to become a real yes-no question where they can no longer pretend to split the difference, right?
Yeah, because, you know, what's the main opposition to ISIS, Islamic State in Syria, is the Syrian army. And the Syrian Kurds, who are part of a group called the YPG, which is in turn the affiliate of the main Turkish Kurd organization, the PKK, which the US and the European Union have down as a terrorist organization. So are they not going to help? They are under attack. There's a northern Kurdish enclave with 500,000 people in it on the Turkish border, and already about 150,000 have fled. They're under attack from ISIS. So is the U.S. going to launch an attack on ISIS to defend this enclave? So I think when you think about the practicalities of it, they really don't have any choice but to cooperate with all these people they've been denouncing for years, who are actually the people who are fighting ISIS on the ground. Otherwise, their only alternative is a group which doesn't really exist, which is going to be vetted and then trained in Saudi Arabia and then come back to the battlefield. So it's sort of fantasy. Now, in the south, well, they don't seem to have had airstrikes on south of Damascus. There is a sort of rebels who are coordinated by sort of foreign intelligence agencies in Amman who've been trying to fight their way towards Damascus. But here's another problem that, you see, there isn't much distinction between the so-called moderate rebels and the jihadis like Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the Syrian affiliate of al-Qaeda. You know, it's really sort of absurd to think that you have an opposition area that with Jabhat al-Nusra, ISIS in it, that they're not fighting side by side with these so-called moderates. So, you know, again, they have to decide what they're doing. Now, you know, at the moment, it's a tremendous mess. The first days of bombing always look good. You know, I've been sort of over the years in Baghdad and elsewhere, you know, bombing that there are various targets initially that they can identify. But after a bit, there aren't any targets where the enemy is. They won't know where these people are. Mm-hmm. So then you start hitting places. You'll certainly hit civilians. So, you know, it's a policy that sort of looks good today, but I wonder if it's going to look good in a few weeks.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and it's interesting, like you say, about how the GCC countries there, they hate Assad so much that Obama's kind of roping them into this and sort of putting them de facto on Assad's side before breaking it to them that, yeah, you're on Assad's side here in this thing and that we have to turn you against the groups that you've been helping us support all this time. Because after all, it blew up in their face, apparently a lot bigger than they possibly imagined it could. And now they are having to try to turn the thing around. But, you know, and I could see how, like you're saying, if they split the difference for a while or try to, that helps legitimize the process to the GCC states. But I wonder about whether including and I guess I'd throw in Jordan there. That's UAE, Saudi, Qatar, Bahrain, Jordan, all participating in this to some degree or another. And I wonder whether you would agree with Michael Scheuer that this just completely discredits them. This is like the final nail in the proof of the coffin that they're nothing but lackeys and sock puppets of the Americans, and that the only ones who don't take their marching orders from the Americans in the region are the Islamic State, the guys that we're trying to fight here.
Well, there's an element of that, but it, you know, these Gulf monarchies, they always, you know, they try and stay in business. You know, we talk about Saudi Arabia, we're talking about a royal family, you know. Nobody elected these people. Their own legitimacy will now be under question from the Islamic State, who'll say exactly that. They'll say, look, these people are claimed to be Muslims, but in fact they're lackeys of the Americans. And they'll find believers in these places. I think one thing that I don't see discussed, certainly not over here, maybe in the States, is the one of the things we know about the Islamic State, about ISIS, is that it always retaliates if anybody does anything it doesn't like. And these airstrikes, how is it going to retaliate? Is it going to retaliate? You know, it's will there be more executions? But, you know, that doesn't do them that any good. So I think this idea that you can have an air campaign going on for years and these guys won't retaliate in some way is very naive. Mm-hmm. I think it's things are going to boil up much faster than that. Yeah. And, of course, if there is retaliation, then the incentive to go in and try and finish the job will go up.
Right. Well, and, you know, I wonder if you think that those beheading videos are just bait. Michael Scheuer on the show said, oh, that's just them putting a worm on a hook, trying to get us to invade. They need us to invade because they know that we can never really defeat them. And over the long haul, it'll just help make their radical case.
It might be like that, but it's kind of speculative, you know. Maybe they just think, you know, if you ritually murder a lot of people in front of cameras, you're going to intimidate somebody. I mean, you may also provoke them, as in this case. They may just have got it wrong. It could be the other. It could be that they're just overconfident after their victories over the summer. After all, they beat the Iraqi army very quickly. Then they beat the Syrian army in a couple of battles in eastern Syria. Then they did the same to the Kurds. It may, after all, these people believe that they are divinely inspired. They may just have got overconfident. It isn't necessarily a trap. But let's suppose that that even if it isn't a trap, what ISIS will be able to present itself as fighting against America, while these other powers have all acted like pawns of Washington. Certainly that will be the thrust of its propaganda, and certainly it'll find believers.
Mm-hmm. Well, and especially when it's just air attacks, where, as you said, all the original targets get taken care of real quick, and then eventually each airstrike is just that much more propaganda for their side and that much less of an actual value of any destruction gained by our side. And so then I guess what it would take would be a whole lot of ground troops, but that just makes matters that much worse for us and that much better for them, at least in a way anyway, and in a different way.
Yeah.
I guess.
You see, you know, if you have an army, you know, like the Iraqi army in 1991 or 2003, which is in fixed identifiable positions, then air power is very effective because you can find out where they are. They don't really have any anti-aircraft guns and you can destroy it. But if, as what seems to be happening and has already happened in Iraq, remember the U.S. has been bombing Iraq since the 8th of August, and ISIS is still being pretty successful in Iraq. In the last few days, they besieged a government position garrison west of Baghdad and seem to have, you know, captured or killed about 300 people. They're still controlling crucial areas to the south of Baghdad. So they can still fight and they can still win. It's more difficult for them just to go barreling down the main highway in their trucks packed with gunmen. But it doesn't mean that they're going to be eliminated anytime soon. It doesn't even mean that they're going to be contained.
Yeah, in other words, we turn them back into an insurgency. but it's far from eradicating them. But then, so, well, here's the thing. I know you have an article here where you say, you know, there should at least be a truce between the anti-ISIS rebels and the Assad regime for now, and it seems like Assad soldiers and in combination with the Iranians and the Iraqi army are the, and I guess if you could get the Turks involved, are the most suited in the region to actually going in there and conquering these guys. But if America pursues any or all of those policies, it seems like it just makes matters that much worse too, because it just puts America back again directly on the side of the Shiites in the war. I obviously we're on all sides of it all over the place. But, you know, if America is serving just as the Air Force for the Quds Force, then isn't that just going to, you know, strengthen them? Same thing with switching back to Assad. I certainly, you know me, I never supported the rebellion against him or thought that the Western powers should be supporting the rebellion against him. But switching back to him is virtually the same thing as far as what benefit it is to his enemies, it seems like.
Yeah, it's all pretty cynical, really. I mean, I've always felt about the uprisings of 2011 in Syria, Egypt, and Libya, and Yemen, that, you know, what tainted them, because they were genuine uprisings against oppressive dictatorial regimes, is that the U.S. and others supported them, but who are the big allies in supporting these democratic, secular uprisings were Saudi Arabia and these absolute monarchies, you know, that regimes that come out of the Middle Ages. It was never likely that these people were in favor of spreading democratic rights to anybody. They certainly hadn't done it at home. So there was a strong element of hypocrisy there. And of course, they used their vast financial resources. The end of the uprisings that got supported in Libya and Syria were the jihadis, were the most bigoted, the most regressive people. And that's one of the reasons they came out on top. But that's where the money was going. Mm. So, you know, it's a very simple reason there, but somehow it doesn't get spread around very much.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so what about Abadi? Do you have any reason to believe the new prime minister of Iraq can find a way to work with Sunni tribal and religious leaders and maybe some politicians in a way that could in any way replicate the so-called awakening movement and the undermining of support from within the Sunni community in the lands that ISIS has already conquered?
Well, you know, I'm sure they'll try, and I'm sure there will be those who'll try and who'll do that. But it'll be very difficult, far more difficult than it was in 2007. There were 150,000 American troops there at that time. The ISIS is much more powerful than Al-Qaeda in Iraq, its predecessor. It's very paranoid, and it will be expecting a stab in the back. It's already sort of detained various people. I just can't see that that really happening effectively. There's another thing that isn't brought up very much about ISIS, which is it tends to recruit, you know, from the poor Sunni young men, unemployed, pretty hopeless. There's a sort of social element in this uprising, too. They really don't like the Sunni leaders. They think they've sort of betrayed the faith. They think they've betrayed their community. They think they're a bunch of fat cats in Baghdad. I mean, they're quite prepared to kill the Shia, but they're quite prepared to kill these guys too. And it's true in Syria as well that, you know, they recruit from these people who you sometimes see referred to in newspapers as underclass. I think the simplest thing is they're the poor, you know, with things are pretty hopeless. And they seem to be where ISIS recruits.
Yeah, well, you know, best Arab paying nationalism. Job in town.
Sorry?
I said best paying it's, job
it's
in town.
It's a job,
right?
But it's also, you know, it's sort of, it's something to believe in, you know, yeah. It's not only the best, it's probably the only job around, you know. And these people are pretty angry and they'll fight pretty hard. The, right. You know, Arab nationalism that you used to have was very much a sort of, tend to be the middle classes, tend to be the professions, tend to be the army. Didn't resonate quite so much with the sort of broad masses of the poor. But the sort of born again, the religion that, the old style religion that ISIS believes in, that does. That has a real constituency among the Sunni poor.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, what about that blowback again from America supporting the Iranian-backed Shiite government against these, you know, the Sunni populations again in the name of fighting ISIS? How bad is that going to backfire? Is it possible that's a pretty good way to get rid of ISIS in a pretty severe way, and maybe we'll be able to keep them, you know, mostly marginalized? Or is that just a recipe for absolute disaster, sending Soleimani?
I think various
there?
Other things have got to happen, Scott. You know, the one thing I think to take on board about these bombings today, these airstrikes today, or airstrikes by the U.S. earlier in Iraq, or even the victories that ISIS won in the summer in Iraq and Syria, is that, you know, these were significant, but nobody was ever going to come out 100% the winner. And so this war is going to go on. I mean, these airstrikes, yeah, it'll sort of maybe contain it'll ISIS, and they'll suffer casualties, but they're not going to go out of business, far from it. But they probably don't have the strength to win in Syria or Iraq. So, you know, we have a lot more things that can happen. What happens if they retaliate against the US, you know, or let's say Britain? You know, people here talk about, you know, could they do anything, come to the homeland? But they don't have to. There are 2.5 million British tourists every year in Turkey. Not difficult to cross the Turkish border. So there are lots of things, many of them pretty nasty, that could still happen.
Yeah, and then I guess it's pretty obvious most of the time how people react to things like that. They double down. The British and the Americans are the same. They're going to double down and not learn a lesson and finally stop intervening just because there's another attack or 10 more.
Yeah, I think that at the moment, you know, because of these executions of two American journalists and the British aid worker, of course, there's much more public support for doing something about ISIS, but there isn't support for a long war. And in this case, I think sort of public feeling that, you know, you can very slip back into the quagmire in Iraq and Syria, you know, is probably better than that of politicians who've got it, you know, they got it wrong in 2003 and they got it wrong in 2011. And I think they're getting it wrong now.
All right, so that's Patrick Coburn. The book is The Jihadi's Return, ISIS and the New Sunni Uprising. You can't get it at Amazon yet. You got to go to orbooks.com. That's orbooks.com. And, of course, you can read him regularly in The Independent at independent.co.uk. And they reprint just about all of it, too, I'm pretty sure, at UNZ.com. That's UNZ, UNZ.com. Thanks very much for coming back on the show, Patrick. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, y'all. And coming up here in just a minute, Peter Van Buren, former State Department official who was stationed in Iraq for a while. He's got this new piece at Tom Dispatch, and he's going to tell us about a little bit of his time there and what he learned from the original Sunni awakening and what he thinks are the chances for another one. That's coming up in just a minute. This is the Scott Horton Show. Follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. See you in a minute. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Oh, you know what? I meant to ask Patrick Coburn about what Dan Sanchez asked about Saudi support for the rebels in Libya. Yeah, there was some of that, Dan. I don't know if you're listening right now, but I'm going to find you that footnote, dude. Just hang tight. All right, on the line we got Peter Van Buren. Next in alphabetical order on my Skype list. from Patrick. He is the author of The Ghosts of Tom Joad. Not the. Sorry. Just Ghosts of Tom Joad. A Story of the 99%. As well as We Meant Well. How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. And he blogs at his website, wementwell.com. Whoa! Calling from live in the middle of a hurricane somewhere. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Scott, this is Peter Van Buren. It's difficult to hear your side of the conversation, but it's good to be with you otherwise. I'm afraid I'm having a hard time here. Are you? If you're able to hear me, let's try to continue. If not, let's try to break and reconnect.
Yeah, I was wondering. It sounded like you were in the middle of a storm there. Is it any better now?
Oh, yes. Yes, there you are. So thank you. The storm is actually over Syria and Iraq right now.
Yeah.
I'm gratefully in New York City, where it's a little more peaceful. But unfortunately, we're back. We're talking about war in the Middle East once again. And we're talking about an expanded war. The president has made war now on a new country, Syria, which is either the seventh or the ninth country he has attacked, depending on how you count these things.
All right. Well, I'm glad. It sounds like we've got our audio problem straightened out. Thanks to the boys in Maryland for turning the dial to the right setting there that we can continue this conversation. They get their copy, too. Peter Van Buren, Back to the Future in Iraq, is the brand new piece at tomdispatch.com. Of course, we'll be running it tomorrow at antiwar.com. And, boy, it is the same thing all over again. Apocalypse Now, Iraq Edition. That's the subtitle here. And we went over quite a bit of this on the show last week, but that's all right. You've got it together as good as anybody as we just get going in what I think you correctly say, unfortunately, is just the very beginning of the same damn thing again that we've already been through here, years of horrible, bloody war in Iraq.
It really does get under my skin. You know, I felt when I left Iraq in 2010 and when my book about Iraq, We Meant Well, came out in 2011, that was largely it. I expected Iraq to devolve into some form of chaos that would eventually sort itself out into three statelets, a Sunni, a Shia, and a Kurd statelet, and though they'd fuss with each other, that was kind of where it was supposed to end. Unfortunately, it hasn't ended there, and even more unfortunately, the United States has blindly plunged right back into the swamp in an attempt to accomplish with fewer resources what we failed to already accomplish with many more resources, and that is to create a united, single Iraq. It's metastasized into Syria now, and America is again at war in the Middle East.
You know, I wonder, of course, a lot of people are cynical and think that the American plan was always to break them up, like there were two parallel plans. One, you know, in the name of holding Iraq together, but the other that was quite deliberately siding with the secessionists among the Shiites and those who would kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad. And I mean, I guess Barzani and Talabani, there's nobody to pick from among the Kurds who aren't secessionists to one degree or another there. It's pretty much consensus in their system, but you know, Joe Biden has been very upfront about this since before the war, that he always thought Iraq should be broken in three, and he thought America should do the breaking. And so, you know, I wonder if, because after all, we just talked about this with Patrick Coburn. Yeah, I guess they're going to try, but like you just said, they're going to accomplish the, you know, the cooling off or the warming up or whichever temperature metaphor you're supposed to use, the rapprochement between the Sunnis and, you know, the Sunni, you know, power holders, I guess, the religious leaders, the tribal chiefs and whatever with Baghdad, you know, based on, without, as you said, without the resources that they had the last time they tried it, and it didn't work back 7 years ago.
Now, the thing that caused me to title the article out today, Back to the Future, is that we are trying the same plan. The plan back in 2007 was that the surge, which is just a more marketable term for an escalation, of course, was going to create the political space. The U.S. Army was going to sit on everybody and create the political space that would allow the Sunnis and the Shias to sort out their issues and unite into a government in Iraq. We hadn't really figured out what to do with the Kurds at that time, so let's leave them aside as well. And to help along with this, the United States was going to buy off the Sunnis, and we did that through by identifying the so-called moderate Sunnis of the time and paying them lots of money to break with al-Qaeda and either come to our side or at least stay kind of neutral. And this is how the foreign fighters were going to be ejected from Iraq and unity was going to be achieved. Well, I think we can tell from today's headlines, if nothing else, that didn't really work out. Once again, however, that's the plan. United States air power and whatever sneaky stuff we're doing on the ground is designed to create political space that will allow the so-called new government of Iraq to achieve unity. We're still looking for these moderate Sunnis in Iraq, and in hopes of, if we do stumble upon them, that we can talk them into breaking with ISIS, and thus that whole problem is solved. Obviously, the difficulties are fairly straightforward and were laid out in 2007. I mean, what's new in the picture is that the Sunnis are unlikely to be unlikely to go along. I mean, once bitten, twice shy.
Right.
And after trusting the Americans in 2007 and getting the dirty end of the stick, it seems unlikely that they would make the same mistake twice, even though apparently we are. If you're talking about conspiracy theories or secret plans or something like that, I think the one that might be worth focusing on, and it's not even very, very secret, is how reentering the Iraq war really was just the way of lubricating the system, if you'll forgive the analogy, to get us into Syria. Over the last, 5 weeks, we've gone from no presence at all in either country to a humanitarian mission in Iraq, to a larger mission in Iraq, to airstrikes, and then, as of last night, we're bombing in Syria, with or without some kind of coalition, whatever.
The road to Damascus runs through Baghdad the hard way, huh?
We're going the long way around it, but the connection between the slippery slope in Iraq that seems to have led us down the hill into Syria is one that's very, very hard to ignore.
Yeah.
And so I'll throw out there for the audience to chew over how much of the reinsertion into Iraq really was nothing more than sort of setting up what the U.S. government really wanted to do, which is find a media palatable way to engage in Syria.
Mm-hmm. Which, and by that you mean bomb ISIS targets there, or you mean a backdoor to still regime change against Assad in Damascus?
Well, I suspect that the goal is both or all or whichever we might accomplish. I think the United States recognizes two groups that it would like to get rid of in Syria. One of them, of course, is the quote-unquote terrorists, you know, whatever collection, and the other is Assad. I don't think the United States wants to see either of them there a year from now.
Right. Oh, man. Yeah, boy, what Syria's going to look like after the de-bothification there. Talk about a bloodbath. Holy crap. All right, hold it right there. It's Peter Van Buren, everybody. We'll be right back after this. WeMeantWell.com, TomDispatch.com. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm talking with Peter Van Buren, former State Department official, author of We Meant Well, about his time in Iraq. That's also his website, WeMeantWell.com. He's got this new one at Tom Dispatch, Back to the Future. Same dang failed policy again. I wanted to go back real quick before we... let me mention real quick two footnotes real quick. If anybody wants to read A Clean Break, A New Strategy for Securing the Realm, or Coping with Crumbling States, I forgot the subtitle of that one, both by David Wurmser. Those are both available at my website, scotthorton.org/fair use. And you can find that's the Road to Damascus Runs Through Baghdad and all that, the neocons, Dick Cheney's Middle East advisor. David Wurmser is the primary author there. All right, so anyway, and then I wanted to say one thing quickly about the awakening thing, about the deliberate plan, where they're trying really hard to hold the Iraqi state together, and they really wanted to integrate these sons of Iraq into the army and all that. Sounded on its face like a plan, not necessarily one that was going to work very well, but that it was something that it was really worth a try. It really does seem, now that I think about it and listen to you talk about it, Peter, like it really just backfired, right? This was an attempt to take advantage of the end of the war for Baghdad to try to get a cooling off in the civil war altogether and try to figure out a way to integrate the Sunnis with under the Baghdad government in the city they'd lost enough to, as you say, more or less get by kind of in somewhat crisis, but for the long term, less than the full scale problem. But what really happened in effect by paying them and arming them and calling that truce was they really solidified a state at the same time that they had given the Shiites, the Shiite parties, I mean, not the people, but the Shiite leaders, no reason to compromise with the Sunnis anymore since they had Baghdad, and so screw them. They had also then given the Sunnis less and less incentive to want to try to reach out with and work with, reach out to and work with the Baghdad government, because after all, Petraeus was paying them handsome sums of money and paying their forces to walk around with machine guns, ruling the place, etc. And so, in effect, it sounds like it really just backfired, and what they ended up doing was securing the de facto independence of the west and northwest of the country and Shiistan from Baghdad to Basra.
And now the irony is that America's actions, the plans we discussed before the break, and those will fail, but America's actual actions are going to create exactly the situation that the president says we don't want to create. We have acknowledged Kurdistan as an independent entity. We have allowed the Kurdish forces, the Peshmerga, to fight fully independently of the Iraqi state army. We are arming them separately, supporting them separately. We're allowing the Iraqi state army, the Shia forces, to use their militias in combat, because the Iraqi army itself, of course, fell apart. And we are acknowledging those differences. The Kurds are being allowed to sell oil independently again. Kurdish tanker that had been held in off the coast of Texas was allowed to offload. The Kurds have been selling oil directly to Israel, and that will further separate the Kurds from what you called Shiistan. Meanwhile, the persecution of the Sunnis by the same Shia militias that hunted them down during the American occupation can't do anything but make it clear that there is no place for them in a so-called unified Iraq. So America's actions have really set the stage for exactly the thing that America said we don't want. As for Syria, what you're finding there is another recipe for another chaotic state, as we saw in Libya. Yemen is unraveling before our eyes. Ironically, the president cited that as a success, a week ago or so. In Syria, you are going to be removing one, if not both, of the centers of power, ISIS and its various subgroups, which is one center of power, and the Assad government, which is the other center of power. Once one or both of those groups are gone, what's left is chaos, a bunch of smaller players struggling for bits and pieces of the body that they can pick over. We've seen this happen in Libya. We certainly saw it happen in Baghdad in 2003. And we're watching it happen in Yemen and other places, South Sudan, etc. Mm-hmm. We're back to that standard old joke that mental illness is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. But my goodness, if there was a phrase that described American policy and strategy in the Middle East right now, that's the one that I'd pull out.
Man, you know, here's the thing, though. I mean, okay, insanity is insanity and all of that. But continuing to support the Mujahideen against Assad after all of this, that's not just insanity. That's absolutely crazy. That's so crazy that it's treasonous. They are siding, in effect, still with the guys who have out loud in public in the Sunday Times sworn their allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri. I mean, what in the world? And I'm not at all on the side of those who would say we should have, that George Bush, for example, should have ever, you know, worked with Assad to torture and kill these guys or anything like that. We shouldn't have a pro or anti-Assad position. But to keep supporting the rebellion, at least, even though I think it would backfire horribly and be a bad policy, at least on its face, Peter, switching back to Assad makes some sense. But this whole thing about we're going to create a brand new Mujahideen to fight all the rest of the Mujahideen and Assad at the same time is just, I don't know what they're doing. Just now I was talking with Patrick Coburn, and he was saying, basically by just logical default, they must be in effect switching back to Assad and calling off the regime change, right? Or, I mean, is it really that crazy where Richard Perle's darkest dreams are actually still to be implemented in the face of all these results?
You know, the fact that no one seems to know, and the fact that any path, I mean, if you were to sit down and say, let's dispassionately make the argument that the United States is trying to get back towards supporting Assad, again, to sketch that path out, it's very, very difficult. Looking at the airstrikes that took place last night, the United States had to blow a hole in Assad's air defenses to get to the locations where supposedly ISIS was located. The attack came out of the Mediterranean, and the Tomahawk missiles were used to blast their way past Assad's air defenses over the coast and get to the interior of the country. It seems difficult, if not impossible, to wage war in a place as small as Syria and not end up killing people on every side of the conflict. It's beggars the imagination to try to see the logic behind any of this, regardless of which position you think the United States is taking or that you want to argue for. None of them add up. Yeah. It seems as if the only goal is to, quote, do something, even with the knowledge and certainly the historical precedent that doing something will result in both counter to American stated goals and, of course, the chaos.
Well, you know, another thing that Patrick said was we're going to see the test here real quick when ISIS makes a move again on Aleppo. And then when it's the battle for Aleppo, whose side is America going to be on in that? The rebels or the state? It's going to be one or the other at this point because now we're up to our neck in it.
That's a big thing to watch. The other thing that could happen is sort of the opposite. In other words, ISIS will go right for the classic insurgent move, which is to pull out of the cities, fade into the population, and try to draw the United States deeper into the conflict. That's what happened in Iraq. It's what happened in Vietnam. It is insurgency 101. You don't stand and fight the Western powers. They've got tanks and airplanes and Tomahawk missiles, and you don't. What you do is you disappear and you draw them in, and then once they're on your territory, you do what you need to do. That's certainly how a bunch of people with second grade educations and rusty AK-47s have fought the United States to at least a draw, if not a defeat, in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Well, also Vietnam.
Yeah, and speaking of which, I mean, their plan is, their stated goal is now that, oh yeah, no, they're leaving. They're going to have maybe 10 or at the most 20,000 troops after the end of this year, and they're going to call it a victory. But meanwhile, it's completely agreed all the way around that the Taliban's ready to walk right back into Kabul. They're kind of already there in a huge way. That's the same kind of situation they're facing here, where they've sworn to destroy Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the same one they destroyed over and over already. That's now grown into this.
It's a shame, and I'm terribly afraid, Scott, we're going to have to talk about this many, many more times before we're anywhere close to the end.
Yeah, I know it is. It's like 2003 right now. They're just getting started again. Bad news. All right. Read all about it, TomDispatch.com, everybody. Thanks very much, Peter. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Peter Van Buren, y'all. See you tomorrow. Thanks very much for listening.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.